Should we kick this thing off?
Yeah, sure.
Colin, would you like to maybe start us off with an inspirational speech to really get the energy going?
I want to have the best podcast of all time.
Unlikely, but let's give it a shot.
Hi, everybody. We'd love to get your feedback. You can post a review wherever you found this podcast. Find us on Twitter at RealDMC or send us a message at feedback@realdmc.com. If you send us some feedback, we may include it in our listener feedback section and you'll hear it on the show. Thank you for listening and now on to the episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real DMC podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. So right up front, just a quick sad note and a goodbye to two recent actors who passed away. The first one would be Ray Liotta, so obviously known for his performance in Goodfellas, probably exactly beyond anything else.
Karen!
I was actually going to recommend that we all
Karen!
Do Karen in his honor. Karen! Karen! Yes, but of course, obviously well known for Goodfellas. He also made a very fun, cheesy B movie called No Escape. I don't know if you guys remember that, but it was an island prison dystopian kind of situation. And I will say that he had a very intense performance in the movie Narc. I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Narc in a while. Have you?
No.
It's worth checking out, actually. Both Ray Liotta and Jason Patrick, really good in that movie. Not necessarily the feel-good movie of the year, however. And then the other actor we just want to do a quick shout-out to is Fred Ward, which, you know, if you grew up in the 80s and you went to someone's birthday party, you probably saw Remo Williams in the theater. He also had a fun role, not a fun role because it's a depressing one, but in Uncommon Valor, he played the tunnel rat that stabbed a couple kids to death and had some PTSD because of it. So yeah,
how do you not mention Tremors as a fun role?
Dude, I'm getting to it, all right?
Okay. So,
yes.
Don't bury the lead.
No. So then he had the truly iconic role of Earl Bassett in the movie Tremors, which for me personally, Tremors is one of my favorite movies of all time because it's just a great, fun monster movie. I think he has amazing chemistry with Kevin Bacon, great comedic timing in that movie, and just across the board, his character I think is just tons of fun. So that one was a real loss. So
that one hurt. Yeah, that one really hurt. Love Fred Ward.
Yeah. So goodbye to two beloved actors. And on that sad note, I guess we'll get to the rest of the pod now.
It's the Real DMC Death Podcast.
I was going to say, it's not a particularly inspiring upfront portion, but we'll press on.
We want to guess who's going to die next?
No, I prefer not to. So I know there are a couple that are coming relatively soon, and some of those are going to be very sad just due to the age of the actor. So from our listener feedback section, so we did receive some feedback from our frequent listener, Mary Lou, who said, Prometheus, stupid film with characters that were clueless. Colin's rationalization throughout the podcast was illogical. So, Colin, any quick thoughts or a response there? I will say, by the way, listening to Prometheus, you actually seem to get on board with the stupidity and get frustrated with the stupidity along the way as we're talking about that movie. So, but apparently you still are definitely going to ride for Prometheus. Is that correct?
No, I fully acknowledged the stupidity of the characters, which I believe I said right at the top. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to do the movie, is because for some reason I really like it, but I totally acknowledge that they are dumb characters, and yet I keep coming back to it. There are other positives to this movie. And so, Mary Lou, my rationalization was not illogical.
No, I don't know. I mean, well, I don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Who's to say?
I'm to say. I'm the one that was a goddamn podcast. All right.
Okay. Well, moving on to today's film. So the movie we're here to discuss today is director Rian Johnson's third film from 2012. Let's talk about Looper.
I am one of many specialized assassins called Loopers. We eliminate people from the future. Time travel has not yet been invented. But 30 years from now, it will have been. So when criminal organizations in the future need someone gone, they zap them back to me. And I do the necessaries. The only rule is never let your target escape. Even if your target is you.
I'm gonna fix this! I'm gonna find her! Luke! I'm gonna kill him!
You know what's gonna happen? You done all this already?
I know that you're still gonna kill him.
Who?
Have you heard of the Rainmaker?
New boss in the future.
Mass executions. The Reign of Terror. He lives here, now. But I'm gonna stop him.
None of this concerns me.
This is gonna happen to you.
It happened to you. It doesn't have to happen to me. This is my life now. You had yours already.
Colin, you made this pick. Why did we watch Looper?
Why not?
Maybe. So, by the way, you gave me a bunch of shit on the last podcast about the process we use for picking. So I'm expecting to be wowed by the reason why we got to Looper today.
Okay, well, generally my strategy for picking films is to pick good films that I like, that I want to watch again. And usually you guys, except for Prometheus, which I acknowledged up front, had stupid characters, but all the other films, I think you guys would really enjoy. And you do. And you do. You know, this came out in 2012. I think I saw it about a year after it had come out. I think it was kind of a small film at the time, but it was really well-reviewed. And I was just kind of blown away. I'd never heard of Rian Johnson before. And I was taken in by this movie. I think it was really well-made, very well-written. I think it's a really great performance by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I loved how they tried to make him look like a young Bruce Willis. And it's an unusual time travel concept. And so this is why I chose to make this my pick, because I really like this movie and I wanted to share it with you.
That's a much better answer, by the way, than why not. So thank you for thank you for articulating your actual thoughts behind it.
I do love a good time travel mind bend. So it's a fun one, I thought. Good choice. Good pick.
Yeah, it was a good pick.
That's what I'm here for, guys.
So by way of general introduction, so the film maintains a 7.4 rating on the IMDb and has a Metacritic score of 84%. The box office for this was $66 million in the US and $110 million international, so for a grand total of $176 million. And that was off of a budget of $30 million. So definitely can say that this was a financial success, because it was, I think it made close to six times its actual budget.
I expect to be a bigger budget. I thought it looked great. Really well done.
Yeah, seriously, for $30 million, they really sort of knocked it out of the park. It didn't have too many special effects. They were all pretty much like practical effects. And they didn't really need that much either. And one of the reasons why is because this is not a movie about time travel. It's just a movie that uses time travel to have a very, very interesting story.
Yeah, that's what's one thing that's really interesting about this movie, is that time travel is a mechanic, but it's really not the focus. And so that is actually somewhat refreshing, right? Because most of the time when you have a time travel movie, a lot of it is based on, okay, well, you know, the complexity of the time travel, or what happens when you go through or go into the past or the future or whatever it's going to be. And this is not that movie. I mean, time travel is just sort of it's really a transit system is really what it is. That's really what it comes down to. That's all it's being used for.
Yeah, Rian Johnson, who's the director, he wanted this movie to really be character-based, and he wanted it to be like more about how the characters themselves deal with the impacts of time travel, rather than being a movie that is directly about time travel.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he didn't want to spend a lot of time for the audience to try to like figure out the rules of time travel. He just sort of put it out there, made it simple to comprehend, and then get to the story. And it was really effectively done.
Yeah, I think they address it nicely too in that diner scene when they're like, I don't want to talk about time travel.
Like, yeah, we'll talk about that, because that's a great use of some exposition to say, we're not going deep on this. So if you have a bunch of questions you need answered, you're not going to get that out of this movie.
Yeah, that was
now
good.
Now, that doesn't mean that people haven't tried to go deep on this. And, I did as well. We'll probably talk about a little bit about that as well. And yeah, if you try to do that, much like most time travel movies, you're going to find issue. You're going to find paradoxes, and it's not going to maybe be as satisfying. But this movie is not about that. You know, you just look past that stuff and just realize that it's a cool concept and it helps drive a really great character-driven story.
So how about your, you know, history with this film? Is this a movie that you saw in theaters? Did you see it soon after it came out?
Yeah, I saw it like on Blu-ray. I just had read some things about it. There wasn't a lot of like really good sort of intellectual type of science fiction out there. And this movie takes place about 30 years in the future. I think the sort of some of the world building that they did was really interesting. And, you know, it's dystopian. And so it sort of hooked me. So I really wanted to see it. And I loved it from the beginning. And I've seen it now. I think this is probably the third time I've seen it. It's nice to go back every, say, 5 to 6 years and watch it again. Because it really does, I think, hold up.
How about you, Marcus?
Yeah, I don't remember. It was came out the like year my daughter was born, pretty soon after that. So it was all a blur.
It was a blur.
I do not remember when.
Yeah, what's interesting for me is I think I saw this on Blu-ray, and it was probably, it might have been maybe a year or two after it was available on Blu-ray. It took me a while to get to it. For some reason, I almost thought this movie was kind of a smaller independent film or not that well known. And I mean, when you look at the budgetary results, it obviously did very well. So I don't know why I had that perception. It seemed very quiet for a movie that actually ended up doing this well, honestly, in terms of financial performance. I don't know that you heard much about this film. The other thing that I think is interesting, too, is, you know, when you look at the trailer for this film, it's marketed almost as an action film. Like it is mismarketed, in my opinion. You know, if you go back and watch the trailer and you watch the final version of the film, I think that what they're trying to drive in terms of interest with the trailer is not what you get with the final film. And by the way, I think the final film is a better version of what you want to get out of this, particularly for this type of story. So I do think it's interesting that they went the direction that they did with the trailer, just because it sets the wrong expectations, I think, with the audience.
You know, I think it might suffer from coming out in a time period where there was some bad science fiction. You said you had some, you know, bad assumptions about this film.
Yeah.
And so did I. And I feel like I thought at the time, I think there was this movie called Jumper at the time.
Oh, yeah.
With
Hayden Christensen. Was it
Hayden Christensen?
Yeah.
And I think maybe I thought it was that movie, or it was just in the same vein as that movie. And there's another one with...
Isn't one like I Am Number Four? Where there's a couple like that around.
Yeah,
this
there was
time.
A couple like those.
A bunch of like kind of goofy, yeah.
Kind of like, you know, young male stars, yeah. Romance, science fiction, and they weren't really particularly very good.
Yeah.
And I think I just lumped this in with the rest. And this is also not Rian Johnson's first film, but I think his first film was Brick. I had not seen Brick.
And The Brothers Bloom.
The Brothers Bloom too. So I'd not seen either one of those movies until...
I hadn't seen them before. I think I've seen The Brothers Bloom sometime after, last 5 years or something.
I don't think I'd even heard of Rian Johnson until I watched Looper.
Yeah.
And then I was like all over Rian Johnson. I really sought out his films.
Well, because he hasn't done that many. He's done like so few. He's only like his next film after this was The Last Jedi and then Knives Out. And that's it, really. So it's kind of interesting. He has a much bigger name than his resume. I think he's great. Like I think he's fantastic.
We are sliding into Director's Corner, by the way, so do we want to go there? Or?
Yeah, so let's talk about Rian Johnson. He had a couple of films before Looper. I just had never heard of him or those films before. And so it wasn't until I saw this movie, and then I knew who he was, because they said pretty glowing things about him. In these reviews of the movie, and then obviously watching the movie, I was like, wow, I'm sort of blown away. And then I started seeing his name all over the place. And so Emily and I watched Brick, which we really loved. I mean, that was, you know, it's like this film noir that's set in a suburban high school, which I thought was a really inventive premise. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, Marcus, have you seen that movie? Have you seen Brick?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's definitely worth watching. The style and just kind of the mashup of noir and high school movie is actually pretty creative and very interesting. I like that movie quite a bit.
I'll check it out.
And then The Brothers Bloom, I think, was good, not as successful, but it's a movie that I actually want to watch again.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's funny because it reminds me of Knives Out a bit. Like it has a more similar vibe to that than it does, say, sci-fi movies.
Right. And then he did sort of take a kind of a long break, but I specifically recall during Breaking Bad's run that he directed a couple of episodes. I think they were both in 2013. And he actually, I don't know if you know this, but he directed, like, I think it was the third episode from the very end which this episode called Ozymandias.
Oh, is that where they're in the desert?
Yeah.
The money barrels that are buried at that
yes,
point.
Exactly, yes, exactly. And that, I think, might be like the best episode of television that I've ever seen. And it actually is the only TV episode with 1,000 or more ratings on IMDb to score a 10 out of 10.
Hmm. Interesting. So what do you guys think of The Last Jedi?
I liked it a lot. I thought it was a good one. I thought it was the best of the three.
So I would agree with that. I think it is the best of the three. I mean, I think Force Awakens is a fun and interesting movie because you're drawn back into the Star Wars universe, but it's effectively just a remake of
Star
Wars.
Because it's a remake.
It's pandering. Just a remake of Star Wars. So much pandering. It's so bad.
Yeah. But Rian Johnson taking The Last Jedi in the direction that he did was very unexpected, and that's what I found to be very interesting about that film. I don't know that any of those the trilogy films really do that much for me overall, honestly. But they just suffer.
Yeah, is good. I think the three of them suffer because they don't have a cohesive story. They didn't plan out what they're going to do, and they just kind of winged it and changed their mind three times.
Which is a shockingly bad blunder for this particular property. I mean, it's pretty high stakes. So the fact that you don't have it dialed in like the MCU movies just is a shock to me, but whatever.
I don't think Disney really cares since they made like multiple billions of dollars off those movies.
That's true.
Yeah, but still, you got to do a little better.
Oh, and then I saw Knives Out, which I thought was actually quite fun. It was, you know, a nice opportunity for Daniel Craig to kind of have some fun and play this Southern gumshoe character. So a big departure from his James Bond role. And the overall kind of ensemble approach to Knives Out I thought was a lot of fun. So I think he's making maybe even two sequels to that film, because I think it ended up being successful.
Yeah, there's like two sequels planned, I think, which is kind of crazy. I liked it. I need to watch it again because I feel like I think it was like built up way too much, because I don't recall thinking it was that good. Now, it has a 7.9 on IMDb, which is really high.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that's about right?
I think that's running a little hot, honestly. I mean, it's good, but that's probably a little too high. So.
Yeah, that's approaching top 250, like all time. It's a little, probably a little much, but maybe like 7.7, 7.5. I don't know. It was really enjoyable, fun movie. Like, it was good.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch it again. I do recall really liking the whole ensemble and thinking that there were good characters and good actors playing those characters. And so that was good. I just don't know that the overall plot sucked me in.
Yeah. I like those detective movies where you have to like the Agatha Christie type of
murder mystery. Oh, I do too. I love Agatha Christie murder mysteries, the ones that they did in the 70s and early 80s with Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile. I love those movies. My sister and I, and we used to watch them like all the time during the summer in the early 80s. And those are fun movies. And this is probably like a little bit in the same vein as that. Certainly much more so than the new Kenneth Branagh Agatha Christie movies, which... Yeah,
I just watched that one.
Did you watch Death on the Nile?
Yeah, it was fine. It was enjoyable. It's not great, but it was a good movie, yeah.
Just not as good as those old ones.
No. I do think that his films are very kind of tightly composed, I guess is how I would think about them, right? So they're narratively... moving forward, they move at a pretty good pace. You don't feel like there's a lot of extraneous crap in there. And I also do think that, and particularly in this movie, you know, he does some experimentation with camera angles. Like, so the moment when, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt puts the drugs in his eyes and he's walking, and then all of a sudden he rotates the camera, so it's like he's on the ceiling. And then you have the moment where he falls out the window on the fire escape. So same kind of thing where the camera angle, you know, the camera flips around. So he does some interesting stuff with the camera from a direction standpoint that I think is pretty engaging. So I like it.
I don't know if I could articulate the style of Rian Johnson, but I think he wrote this movie, Looper, as well as directing it. And I think that maybe like as an auteur, I do gravitate towards him because I don't know. There's just something about it that I like. I like what he's thinking. I like his perspective. And he's going, at least in my mind, he's taking different genres and he's looking at them a little differently. And I like that.
Well, and I also like the fact that he is a writer director. So that is very interesting. So the where you command full control of the landscape in terms of the characters, the material. So it's all under his umbrella, which I think is, I mean, that's, you know, it's intense and interesting. But for the most part, it seems like you know, I don't think that you see his movies and you walk away thinking, oh, that was a plot hole, or that was something that was left open or exposed, or that was a strange character action. You don't get that out of his films. It feels like most of the stuff that he's doing is very purposeful.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
he's composed. Yeah.
He's written all the movies he's directed.
So appreciate that. Kudos to you, Ryan Johnson. Keep it going.
Yeah. And then this movie was kind of interesting because, like I said, it's not your typical time travel movie. It's not about time travel, but he does pull from the genre in some really interesting films like The Terminator and 12 Monkeys, but also, which I thought was interesting, Witness, which I can totally see that.
Is that what he used for the inspiration for the future assassins and for the outfits?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No, I'm serious. The Amish.
Yeah,
I mean,
I mean, well, you think of just about the whole, you know, like farm scenes and with the small boy and everything, very Witnessy. Akira as well, you know, with the TK and the telekinesis and everything. Who would have thought you can pull from all these like really sort of seminal time travel movies, but all very different, and like take a lot of elements from all of those and make this really cohesive and interesting time travel movie.
Yeah, the Witness thing I can totally see, actually, now that you say that, in terms of the vibe of, you know, when he's on the farm. I get that 100%.
And I would never put like the Terminator meets Witness, you know, that's like, it's like in The Player.
Greenlight
it. It's like the Terminator meets Witness. Yeah.
That is a hell of a pitch if you think about it, honestly.
So what do you think about the cast?
You want to talk about Looper?
I was going to say, so moving on to the cast. So you have Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Joe, and just a general question. What is your kind of overall impression of Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and maybe have you been on a journey in that regard? Because I certainly have.
Have I been on a journey?
Yeah,
thinking about Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yes,
yes, I actually have.
I have. That's why I'm saying it's like legitimately. I have.
Here's the thing. He's like one of those actors who I am sort of drawn to. I really like. I want to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt movies. I really like him, and yet I don't know that there's anything except for this movie that I think he's particularly great in. And usually they're like the smaller roles that I think he really excels in. What do you think?
Well, so my association with him early on was when he was in Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I never watched that show, but I would see all the commercials for that show where he would be this like weird, wacky, like, you know, John Lithgow had the big energy, right? Like lots of big energy. So I saw him and that was kind of my impression. I'm like, well, maybe he's not for me. But then I started to see him in movies, and Brick was one of the first movies that I saw him in. And I was like, whoa, okay. And then I, 50-50, he's really good in 50-50. He's really good in The Dark Knight Rises. In fact, there's a scene where he goes to Wayne Manor to talk to, Batman / Bruce Wayne, Christian Bale. And in terms of The Dark Knight Rises, that's actually one of my favorite scenes in that entire movie. I love the kind of the quiet intensity that he's bringing to the movie. And then recently I saw him in The Trial of the Chicago 7. So he played the prosecuting attorney, one of the two of them. And he was he's really, really good in that. And he's also, if you want to see him in a little bit of a lighter kind of, you know, more sort of effervescent type role, he's in The Walk. I don't know if you guys saw that movie that was directed by Zemeckis. Yeah. The problem with The Walk, in my opinion, is that there's an actual documentary about what that guy did that is just so compelling that it makes The Walk as a movie kind of like hard to sit through, because you can just see the actual documentary and it's kind of crazy. But I'm a big Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan, is what this comes down to. I mean, if I'm actually happy to see him when he shows up in a movie or TV show, and I really like what he brings to the table in terms of just, you know, he can actually go, he can do comedic, he can, you know, bounce down and do serious. He has a sort of really good intensity to him, and I really, really like him, and I really like him in this role.
I totally agree. He has a great range. Like, I forgot that he was on that Third Rock. I remember him from 500 Days of Summer, which is a fun rom-com.
Oh, yeah, that was a good movie.
Yeah. And then, of course, Dark Knight. I thought he was great in that one, too. I think he does a really good job with this. He can adapt to whatever the movie requires. I don't know if it's his smile or whatever it is. He has the ability to, like, be engaging. So I think he's great.
Yeah, and I think he's a really good actor. There's one moment in this movie where, was it Kid Blue, when Kid Blue cocks the gun at him, and the camera's on his face, and it's a close-up shot. And you see the subtle shift, and he's like, now I'm a little bit more concerned. That's just one example to me in watching this movie where like, wow, this guy's actually, he's bringing a lot. So I'm definitely a Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan.
Totally agree. Yeah, he's got great energy, I think. Energy and range. And you're right. He acts in this movie through a lot of makeup, and he pulls it off.
Absolutely.
I know there's some criticism online. People either love the makeup or they don't like it. They find it very distracting because they keep thinking, you know, where is Joseph Gordon-Levitt? Like, they just can't get over it. I'm not like that at all. When I saw him for the first time in that makeup, I was just sort of like taken aback because I thought they did a great job of making a young Bruce Willis. And to me, it was never distracting. Like, I think he should just walk around all the time wearing that makeup. I think he looks great.
My only question is, did you even need it, truthfully, right? I mean, did you need any level of makeup? Because I honestly think you could have had Joseph Gordon-Levitt sitting there across from Bruce Willis, and I probably would have bought it just with how he looks. I mean, I appreciate that the work that they did there, but I mean, I almost think that he could have just pulled it off by himself, honestly.
I don't think it would have worked quite as well. In fact, not nearly as well, because I think Bruce Willis can have sort of an intense, severe look when he's just like sitting there. Whereas I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt has more of a smiley, you know, very positive look on his face, just as resting face. So I don't think so. I think it works. I think it's fairly subtle. You know, they approach this guy, Kazuhiro Tsuji, to do the prosthetics that he wore. And the guy initially just like turned them down because he was like, there's no way. He's like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt does not look like Bruce Willis. But they convinced him to give it a try. And so he's got like a nose piece. He's got an upper lip, a lower lip. He's got some foam pieces behind his ear to pull Joseph Gordon-Levitt's ears back because they're like too big. And then a little bit of a hair piece and stuff. And then the contact lenses, which apparently they were having some problems with all throughout the film because they were blue and then they kept fading. So sometimes you'll see his eyes and they're not quite the same color. But I think it's just like this amazing job. To me, when I watch this, I'm totally sold that young Joe is Bruce Willis 30 years, you know, younger. Yeah, I just love it. I really think they did an amazing job.
I completely disagree. I did not like it at all. I thought he looked goofy. So
you're the one.
Yeah, I'm the one. It took me, like, I wrote in my notes, I was like, what is wrong with this guy? He looks wrong. He looks off. He just does
What's
not
What's wrong
look
with his
right.
face?
Yeah, like, this is not Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It wasn't until I realized,
I think that's the point, though.
But it, I don't know, it just ended up looking so off, and it didn't look normal. And I don't know, that's just because I knew the actor, or if I knew whatever it was. But I did write down my notes, and then I realized, oh, yeah, he's supposed to look like Bruce Willis. Like, I forgot about that.
See?
Well, you don't know it immediately, too. So when you first see him for the first few scenes, you don't know it. So
it's true.
I didn't like it. I side with Dave. I think they could have done without it, and I wouldn't have batted an eye. Because I didn't even think he looked that much like Bruce Willis anyways.
Oh, I didn't think it was necessarily a distraction, though. I mean, I was okay with it being there. I mean, for the most part, I think the makeup is great. And I also appreciate, by the way, that they took Bruce Willis and they also made him more Joseph Gordon-Levitt-like when they were showing some of the flashbacks or as he was, you know, getting older, and some of the stuff they did with the hair, for example. That was all very much, you know, the way that they tied the two characters together and the effort they put into the makeup, I think, is very impressive.
Yeah, they had like 50 pairs of lips. And to be honest, for me, the only time when the makeup didn't quite work was the kissing scene with Emily Blunt, because they had to be very gentle. Rian Johnson wanted them to like really sort of go at it with the kissing, and she kept ripping his lips off.
Yeah, because she was horny. She's horny, dude. She's been out there for a while.
So I understand like why he wanted them to do that. But yeah, it was very challenging due to the makeup.
All right, well, moving on to Bruce Willis. So Bruce Willis plays the older Joe. I actually think this is a really good performance from Bruce Willis. So I know that, you know, he recently, in fact, we mentioned this in one of our pods, that he retired from acting due to aphasia, but I think he's bringing a lot here, and I think he seems to be fully in command. At least that's my read on his performance here.
I would go so far as to say this is his last great performance.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I think so too. Yes, it's funny. I have that as a question or as a note, because I have not watched any of the direct-to-video Bruce Willis films with the exception of maybe a 20-minute block that was something that was on cable, and I was like, no, this is not for me. But he was in a movie, a remake of Death Wish in 2018, and when you watch him in that movie, I remember watching it thinking that, I think it was directed by Eli Roth, actually, there's just something that is not right, particularly in the beginning of that film when it's still the, he's still in the happy, you know, the family's still together moments, and you watch that, and it just, it's like, whoa, something is not right here. And particularly if you go back and watch a movie like Looper, you're like, wow, you know, he's crisp, he's on top of it, it's a very engaging performance. And so I'm trying to think, okay, well, past this film, you know, maybe Red 2, I think, or I recall his performance in Glass being pretty good, so I'd have to go back and watch that again. But beyond that, I think that you might be right. I mean, this might be his last great film.
Dave, let me ask you a question with regard to Die Hard. Which is the last Die Hard film where he's in Russia?
That's the fifth one, A Good Day to Die Hard.
So that movie also came out in 2013, and I'm just going to go ahead and say that his last good performance was Looper 2012. The only one that sort of sticks out is Glass, but I don't think in that movie I sort of noticed him being off.
No, neither did I. That's why I mentioned it. Yeah. So I'm trying to think about, you know, and who knows? I'm not sure if the condition is up or down or if it's easier some days or not. But.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be that A Good Day to Die Hard was just like a paycheck and just a terrible performance.
Well, I think he was just absolutely phoning it in for that movie. He's like, fuck it. I'll just make another Die Hard movie because they're going to pay me $20 million to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, because that was awful. Like, I finally did watch it at your request, and I'm happy I did, and I'm also not happy that I did.
Well, moving on the cast standpoint, is there anything else you want to say about Bruce Willis?
Gollum wants to keep talking about every other movie.
Sorry. I like Bruce Willis a lot in this, but for me, this is a Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie, and maybe that's more because I really love the character of young Joe, and old Joe is not a good person. And
I'm not sure young Joe's a good person either, dude.
Well, no. Okay.
Maybe we could say that Joe is not a good person.
but young Joe at least does redeem himself at the end, and old Joe does not.
I have that as an opening question, too, so we can get to it.
Okay, so moving on then with Emily Blunt as Sarah.
Yeah, I think this is a very good performance. It's, you know, there's not a, I mean, yes, she's scared. She's trying to protect her son. And that's basically it in terms of, you know, oh, and she's horny. So all, you put those three things together, really that defines her character.
Yeah, I think this is like her, this is her first time
So was it scared and horny? Is that?
Oh, she wants that.
She wants to protect her son.
Yeah, she wants to protect her son. So she's maternal, scared, and horny.
Just like you like him.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a great kind of first kind of introduction to Emily Blunt as a almost action star. It isn't until Edge of Tomorrow, which is a few years later, that she really comes out. But I really like her. I think she's fine in this role. I don't think it's asking too much of her, but I think she's great.
No, I think she's good. I think she actually has the, you know, she ups the minor ass kicking, you know, quotient a little bit, right? So she, and although you find out that when she's threatening him with a shotgun, it's only filled with rock salt, but she does shoot him with rock salt at one point, right? So she has no compunctions about causing a little pain as required. And, you know, she definitely comes across as somebody who's going to do what they need to do to protect her son.
She seems tough and believes it.
Yeah. She's tough.
Yeah, she's tough. I mean, she's definitely tough. It's interesting that almost every character in this film is somewhat flawed. I mean, there are some big flaws. They talk about the fact that her character, you know, she effectively abandoned her son early on, right? She was living a different life, and then she came back to him. So it's not as if any one character is standing out here as kind of the golden child, you know, the person in the right. In fact,
the golden child is standing out as the golden child.
No, well, he's blowing people up, but that happens. So
only Wink gets mad.
But yeah, no, I think Emily Blunt's really good in this, and I think actually the Emily Blunt Joseph Gordon-Levitt chemistry, I think, is a real thing. Like that, I think that actually works really well. So I you know, at some point, would love to see them maybe get together and do another project at some point.
John Krasinski vetoes all those projects coming through.
He's like, no. JGL, no, sorry. Chemistry is too good. Not gonna happen.
I'm gonna cut that off.
Yeah, I love Emily Blunt. I really love her in this movie, and I will pretty much watch anything that she's in. In fact, I even watched Jungle Cruise, which came out last year.
How was
Disney
that?
Movie. It's actually not bad.
All right.
My mom gave me the recommendation. Pretty good Dwayne Johnson movie, but if she wasn't in it, it would not have been nearly as good because she's just so great.
We were debating watching that or Death on the Nile, and we ended up on Death on the Nile.
Oh, well, try Jungle Cruise. Of all the Disney rides become movies, it's probably the best one. I don't know. Oh, no, I'm totally wrong because Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, is a fantastic really movie. Yeah. I love that movie.
Of course.
Yeah. So, Dave, I do have a question about Emily Blunt for you.
I know where this is going.
How do you feel about Emily Blunt in The Girl on the Train?
Yes, I was just going to say that. Yes, I will watch any Emily Blunt film. And I'm a huge fan of Edge of Tomorrow, by the way. I think she's fantastic in that particular film with Tom Cruise.
Agreed.
Yeah, she's great in that. And I think they might be making a sequel to that movie. I hope they do. But yes, The Girl on the Train is one of my least favorite movies of all time. And it's because I swear 45 minutes of that movie is where it's just slowly panning on her face as she's staring vacantly. That movie drives me fucking insane. So not a movie for me. I fucking hate it. It's one of the few movies I almost ever walked out on in my life. So you have Paul Dano as Seth. So Paul Dano recently performed as the Riddler in the new Batman movie and was great in that. And here he has a smaller role as Seth, one of the Loopers. And I think it's a good performance. I'm not sure that it stands out very much because he basically is, kind of happy at one point and then scared and hides in a safe. So that's basically it.
He's doing vintage Paul Dano. He just makes a lot out of a small role.
Yeah.
In my mind, he had a much larger role because he just did a lot with it. He's great. I just recently watched, again, Little Miss Sunshine and There Will Be Blood, which is a good double feature, by the way. He is fantastic.
Slightly contrasting tones.
He's a great actor. I really do love him.
Oh, you know, I love him as an actor for sure, 100%. In fact, the little monologue that he gives about what happens when his Looper or his older version shows up and the description and all that, it's very, very compelling. So that short sequence, I think, is actually really interesting when you're watching it. So you have Noah Segan as Kid Blue. And I don't know Noah Segan from many things. I don't know if you guys do.
No, I don't know him at all.
Yeah. He's really good in this role, though. I mean, he has good charisma. He's playing the typical kind of... By the way, I actually think he's the son of Abe. I don't know if that's actually a thing or not, but that's what I think comes across. So I'm not sure if his dad takes a hammer and crushes his hand or if he's just a member of the gang. I'm a little unclear there. But I do think that his intensity in terms of trying to track down the Looper and the way that he handles that oversized gun are kind of fun. So I do like his performance here.
He plays the cocksure Gatman really well.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I ever thought that he was Abe's son, but I could see like maybe a nephew. Because he gives him a
second
lot.
Cousin once removed.
He gives him a lot of rope, you know, and ultimately hangs himself with it. But
yeah,
maybe he's a bastard. He can't be. How could he be?
He's in the future.
Well, this goes into another question about
he could Abe, be Abe.
Because Abe is from the future, right? Oh, my Maybe. God. Oh, that's, my God.
You're right. You know what? Sorry. No, that's the whole time travel thing kind of tripped me up there. Now that you think about it, I'm like,
mind
I'm having a real-time realization. Thank you. Sorry. Wasn't paying close attention, I guess.
He does remind me. He does have a little bit of the David Patrick Kelly energy, too.
David Patrick. Sorry, I thought you were talking about Michael Patrick Kelly.
See 47 pods for additional information on that joke.
Well, then he got, which is what I think is just a really great performance, Jeff Daniels as Abe. Abe, the gangster from the future who's come to run the Loopers. And he's kind of like Bill Murray's brother in Caddyshack. He runs the Loopers. I love this role. Like, it's not a huge role, but I wanted more Abe. Like, I really wanted to know Abe's backstory. Like, they could do a sequel. Well, I can't now because spoiler alert, Abe dies. But there's something about the way he portrays Abe as this tired and exasperated and maybe even like defeated guy who's come from the future, begins this Looper program, and then basically like takes over organized crime in Kansas City. And he doesn't seem like he's having a great time.
No, it's a very, it's an interesting performance because he seems tired.
That's very tired.
He's very tired. He's like, okay, yeah, I got to do this. I got to do this Looper thing. He just wants it all to work and, you know, kind of work quietly. And you get the sense that he doesn't want to really be a heavy-handed boss, right? In fact, there's a couple times where, you know, he's given the opportunity to potentially, you know, kill somebody or send a message, and he just does the, you know, in fact, when Joe comes in for the conversation, he tells him right away that, no, we're not going to break fingers, or we're not going to, you know, I'm not going to hurt you, that kind of thing. So he just disarms the situation a little bit. But I do love seeing Jeff Daniels playing more the heavy or the bad guy. That's fun. Like, that's a nice little shift from most of the characters he plays.
Yeah. Did you see him in Godless?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Love Godless, actually, by the way. Strong recommendation for Godless if you haven't seen it on Netflix.
Yeah. Really, really, really good. Ken Turan, the critic, he said that Jeff Daniels gives an electric, eclectic performance as a man from the future, fed up with living in the past.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, he is. And he even makes a couple of comments to Joe about Joe's like affection for things from the 20th century, whether it be cars or fashion or whatever, like the neckties. And yeah, he just seems like, I'm through with this.
Well, it is interesting because, like, what if you had to go back 30 years and had to live with the experience of the things that were going on or available to you 30 years ago versus now? Right? Like all the internet. I mean, it's streaming. It's
you can't get any good porn.
Well, yeah. You just have to be more resourceful.
No, seriously. Like, you know, you keep looking for your phone. You're like, where's my phone?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why. So I'm kind of curious to know, what is Abe's deal here? Like, what does Abe get out of this?
This is, I think, a really interesting question that they did not look at.
Right.
Because
I think he was more forced to do this than he wanted to do this. That's the energy that he's putting off to me.
Maybe they have something on him in the future or something like that, and he'll protect his family or something.
Or they're going to kill him, or they're going to say, or you can go back and run this Looper program for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, but think about this question, though. So, you know, time travel's outlawed in the future. So only, like, organized crime uses it. And what do they do with it? Well, they use it to get rid of bodies. They kill people. But what happens when the loop runs? Like, it's very bad, right? You got to go find him and kill him, right? Because what could happen? Well, he's from the future. He could end up changing the future, right? So this is you don't want to create these paradoxes. So it's really important that you do kill the loops.
I've seen Back to the Future too. I mean, if that guy comes through with a sports almanac, that's it, man. It's, you know, I was going to say all bets are off, but I guess all bets are on in that case. So
yeah. Well, that's another interesting question because you know they clearly said that he quickly took control of like organized crime in Kansas City, and now he like runs the town. And you have to wonder if he was able to do that using his knowledge of the future. And he probably did like maybe a lot of sports betting, got rich, and was able to, you know, like pay bribes, and maybe that was what fueled his ascendancy.
But if you're Abe in that situation and you're going back, why not just take control of the whole thing? Why not go, you know, kill all the your future bosses when they're kids, like Joe attempts to do or does later in this movie? I mean,
and this is my question, because he's living 30 years in the past and he could change the future. So what is it that keeps him from doing it? Why do they think that, well, in this case, it's okay? And I don't know, but I do wonder, based off of the way that he is so sort of tired and defeated, and his sort of his lair, his criminal lair, is kind of weird. It's almost like that, you know, like to get into his office, it was like you open up this iron door that
it's a bomb shelter, basically.
It's chipped out. Yeah, it's kind of like a bomb shelter. And I wonder if he might actually just be sort of trapped there and he's not allowed to go out because he might affect change
in the future. That's interesting. Yeah.
And because of that, he's like losing his marbles a bit.
Yeah. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that kind of does make sense, actually. You would not want somebody out there causing changes to the future timeline.
Yeah, it's a weird, again, a weird paradox or a weird maybe gap, but again, don't think about it too much.
Yeah. So Pierce Gagnon plays the kid Sid, the little kid. I actually think this kid does a really good performance in this movie, though. I was pretty impressed with that. I mean, I think that the math scene in particular, where, you know, he's throwing some attitude back at his mom, and I think some of the interaction where he's talking to Joe, I think he's really good. I think this is a pretty good child actor.
What age is he supposed to be?
6.
Okay. Then yes, I'll give it to him.
If you, what was the determining factor there? Is like if he was, if he's older,
supposed to be like 11 or 12. I'm like, well, I don't know then. He seemed a little.
He doesn't look 11 or 12 to me, dude.
He does not look 11 or 12.
I couldn't place his age. I didn't think so, but then I thought like he was doing something. I thought they said he was like older.
Well, so Sarah told Jesse that she had a 10-year-old, but she was lying. Yeah. Because he was obviously looking for someone who was younger, and but they knew his birth date because because from those hospital records, and he was 6 years old. And yeah, if I saw him, if I saw him at that time, and he threw a fit, I'd probably run out of the room just thinking about what might happen. So he does throw a good fit, I have to say.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty good child acting performance. I mean, I think he's definitely bringing it.
Yeah, I think I've only seen the movie once before, so I forgot the overall storyline. And so when Emily Blunt runs into the safe, I'm like, that is like pretty poor parenting right there. Kid throws a fit. He just run into the safe and like, you're going to ignore it?
Come on. Is this supposed to be the other way around? Like, he's going to have a timeout, so go sit in the safe.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, she's doing it. And by the way, the first time I saw this movie and I saw her get into that safe, I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that was a really cool, strange moment.
Yeah, you're like, what is going on here? There's something more to this than we don't know.
I do actually want to call out one other person, and that's Garrett Dillahunt, who plays Jesse, the Gap Man at the end, who has an unfortunate ending. I love this guy. He's great. He's a villain in this movie, and yet he comes across extremely likable. Mostly I know him from Raising Hope, which is a comedy series that was on several years ago. And then he's been in a few Westerns. I think he was in Deadwood as well. Every time he pops up in something, I love him. So, and I really like this role as Jesse in the two scenes that we'll probably talk about later.
He's really good in this movie. I mean, he has a combination of charm and menace that he brings simultaneously. Yeah. That's actually, it's a pretty good performance. You're very engaged with it when you're watching it. All right, on to a plot summary. Marcus, what do you got?
Joe makes a good living as a looper, a hitman for the mob, killing and disposing of victims they send back in time from the future. That is, until his future self is sent back to be killed.
Opening questions.
Is old Joe a psychopath? He comes back in time. He's going to kill 3 kids, 2 of which he knows are innocent. But he has no problems going back and killing off 3 people just to save his wife. It seems a little bit crazy.
I don't know that he's a psychopath, but, you know, at this point in his life, you know, he's probably killed hundreds of people.
He's definitely on tilt, for sure.
Yeah.
He's tilting a bit.
He's seeking vengeance, and he sees a way to, you know, get back the one thing that, you know, like truly mattered to him. So,
he himself is never going to get it back, though. That's what's weird about his actions, right? He can do this. He can try to kill the Rainmaker, but then he assumes that his younger self in his current form is going to move forward and continue the exact same path that he was on. But that's already not the case. So it seems like it's a very strange. Because basically at that point he goes back in time, he kills the kids, he's stuck there, and you know his wife is. I mean, I guess he could go, like, you know, try to find his 5 or 7 or 12-year-old version of his wife, which would probably raise a few eyebrows when it came to the marriage and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. It's a strange. It's funny too, because I had not remembered that old Joe comes back and actually slaughters children. Like that was a plot point that somehow escaped me until I sat down for the rewatch. Yeah. I don't think he's, I don't know if he's necessarily a psychopath, but I do think that he's certainly sociopathic for sure, because anybody that can just casually gun down all those people. I mean, because what do you think Joe ends up killing over the course of his life? I mean, they show a montage of all these people coming in and him killing them. But I mean, it's got to be what, 30, 60, 70, who knows what. I don't know how many people he's killed.
A lot.
A lot.
But yeah, I don't know if he's a psychopath, but certainly I'll go sociopath for sure. Colin.
What are your favorite time travel movies?
Well, I would have said Back to the Future probably as my, as the penultimate maybe time travel film. But I do think that Avengers Endgame actually solved all the problems for time travel. So that I might put that towards the top there.
What do you mean by solved it?
Basically, the Avengers Endgame theory that the Hulk puts forward is that, or Bruce Banner, is that there is no ability to change things in the future or the past based on the actions you take, that you're always in your present, right? So you may jump across different timelines or whatever, but for you, it's always the present, and your actions are not going to have collateral damage or effect for people in other timelines. It's not as if you can, they basically said that when, or his, you know, the way that he laid it out, and you can insert the clip here because it'll make perfect sense if you do so. It'll actually just basically be your present regardless of where you are, right? So you may jump through time, but it's always your present, and your actions are just you and your present, and you take that forward with you. So you're not having impact on stuff in the past.
You're right. I should just get the clip because I'm not understanding what you're saying.
I really like Back to the Future. It's fun. Good.
Well, yeah, actually, so more specifically, what he's saying is that the things that you see inside this film...
And you accuse me of talking about other movies.
No, in terms of like writing on your arm or whatever, that's not valid. Like that wouldn't work, because if you are carving up your arm and you are in your present, that's just you in your present, right? So that's what you're experiencing. And the person who came back from the future, they're living their own present. They're not necessarily linked to you based on what happened to them in their past, because they've already lived it. So there's no ability to duplicate a certain period of your life in the past.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand as well. That's one theory. Probably.
Thanks for letting me ramble on for fucking 10 minutes then.
It probably makes sense too if time travel were real.
Right.
So I love things like Edge of Tomorrow, 12 Monkeys. I just watched that, which was a lot of fun. The Terminator is like one of the all-time great time travel movies. And 1960s, The Time Machine, Rod Taylor, probably the first greatest time travel movie. But there's one that I really, really like, and I don't know if you guys have seen it or heard of it. It's from 2004. It's called Primer. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that.
No.
Probably no reason why you would. I stumbled upon it like several years ago. It's a totally low budget movie, but it did win a special prize at Sundance. And it's written by this guy who was, I think he was like a physics student, or maybe has a degree in physics. And he decided he didn't want to dumb it down. He wanted to like put all this science in it. And it's just about these two guys who are like doing some science experiments. They realize that you could, using like superconductors, that they've essentially created a time loop. And it is a trip. I highly recommend checking it out. It's called Primer. It's from 2004.
Cool.
Marcus, you're going to love it. I think maybe you drop some X first, and then you right after you watch the movie, and then you try to diagram stuff. It's fun. In fact, there's a lot of diagrams on the internet about how everything works, which is really fun to look at. But really, trust me on this. Watch this movie. It's really good.
I put it on the list. My other favorite is Star Trek IV, of course. One of the best
whales.
Time travel movies. Good fun.
They're not good the fun. Hell you're whales. okay, so I have a question. So, and I asked this question to Colin, and he picked up on it right away. Marcus, if there's one moment in this movie that doesn't work, what would that moment be? Do you remember?
No.
Marcus, did you watch this movie?
The Miata?
No, not the Miata.
I love the Miata.
It seemed a little weird. The hover bikes?
Well, that, yeah, it is tied to the hover bike. We just, I you know, after watching the movie, I was just talking to Colin. I'm like, oh, there's one moment in this movie that's just kind of a head scratcher in terms of how tight this movie is. And it's at the end when they're on the farm and all of a sudden Kid Blue shows up on the hover bike, like randomly, like just, you know, out of nowhere. And it becomes a strange action movie for about 90 seconds. And then Kid Blue's gone. That moment to me is just sort of strangely tacked on to what is otherwise a pretty tight film. So I just thought, was curious to see if you had the same perception.
I didn't really notice.
Yeah.
I didn't notice it as out of place. It didn't feel out of place to me. It felt like an extra scene probably, but like.
It just felt like an unnecessary action-oriented beat, in my opinion.
I think like, they wanted to wrap up the Kid Blue character. Like, he was hunting him down, so like, let's close that loop, so to speak. Yep.
Well, I have some other questions around the time travel aspect of it. Number one, like, how do they know, like, in the future, they're sending back these loops 30 years. How do they know that the people in the past, like Abe and everyone else, aren't just scamming them? And they're not actually killing the loops because they have no way to verify it, right?
Yeah.
Unless those people show up 30 years later and they're still alive, right?
Yeah, or they don't show. There's some evidence somehow that they're not killed.
Well, I mean, I have a bigger question, which is
like, why do they communicate? Is my question.
Why run the looper program at all? Why would you actually put somebody or force them to be in a situation where they're going to kill their future self? Versus why not just send like, let's just say you have Looper A and Looper B.
Why not send Looper
B to Looper A and Looper A to Looper B and just say, by the way, your loop is closed. Sorry. You know, you're 30 years from now, you're dead. I mean, that makes far more sense. I mean, it doesn't. The whole Looper concept is actually fairly flawed, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think they do it to, like, it's a retirement. So they know they don't have to work again at that point. Like, when you sign up to be a Looper, you go until you have to kill yourself and then you have 30 years. I think just like get an incinerator in the future and don't bother with all the time travel.
Well, I think they were saying that they had to do with like coding or, you know, things that were embedded in terms of people that was tracking. Too easy to track.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do wonder.
They just disappears how, better. Just sending it back in time works better.
Yeah. But again, this is why you for anything time travel related, you know, you can't really focus on that. Because if you do, you're just going to start tearing it apart like we're sort of doing now. And I don't like doing that necessarily with this movie because I love this movie, but I'll still do it. Okay, so it's so difficult to get rid of dead bodies in the future. Why then was old Joe's wife killed so instantly? Like the guy, he hears something and he quickly turns and fires and kills her. Well, what are they going to do with her body? Are they going to like send her back in time?
Well, I don't know that it matters. She's already dead. It doesn't matter at that point though, because the Rainmaker, you assume, has already taken total control. I guess that would be the one.
But they're still doing it, and they're still sending loops back. They were there to take Joe and send him back. So I just don't understand then why, you know, why they wouldn't just kill people in the future and then send the bodies back to be disposed of.
Well,
why,
I don't know what, that based on the mythology that they set up in this movie in terms of time travel, that if you I don't know that you can push too hard on it, because I think you end up in a situation where there are many open questions that suddenly are exposed.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
You have to take a little bit of a leap of faith, because otherwise it's not going to work.
That's what I'm saying. Like I wanted to like point these things out. You know, it's not it, when you dig deep, it's like, okay, well there's a lot of holes here, but you don't need to dig deep, because if you take it for what it is, it's a fun, really interesting movie. I do have a question about the Rainmaker. So it seems to me that he's sort of like the 2074 equivalent of Hitler, because A, he's taking complete control. He's very powerful, right? But it's also like this, the whole story, like time travel. If you could travel back in time, would you kill Hitler before he, you know, came to power? And that's exactly what old Joe is doing. He's going back in time to kill this menacing person.
I think they should have explained that more if that's the case. It didn't seem... In my view, he was not. He was a
crime lord,
a mob boss. Yeah, he was a crime lord, and he just killed Joe's wife. But he wasn't like a mass murderer, like bringing destruction to the world. Like just seemed like Joe's motivation was purely around his own self, and not around like saving the world by doing this.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But he does seem to be this like all powerful telekinetic. Person who, yeah, he's taken over all the major crime syndicates, yes, but I feel like there was also maybe some hint that he was controlling society as well.
Mm.
Somebody said that he had he was responsible for like vagrant purges.
Vagrant purges. I would say that's the only phrase that actually comes into the movie that justifies him as being just a malevolent force that goes beyond the criminal world, right? Maybe he's killing innocent people. Otherwise,
they said he had a reign of terror, mass executions, vagrant purges everywhere at once. Right. So I think maybe he is sort of like, obviously like not Hitler, but sort of that modern equivalent. He's all powerful and he's genocidal, and there's really no way you can take him out.
Yeah, but if he has that power, is he? I guess the question is, you actually don't know what he's doing in the future. That's the problem, I guess. Because let's just say that he evolves to being somebody who is the equivalent of Hitler, then all of a sudden you're on Joe's side to kill the kid, right?
Yeah. I know. Well, so this was my next question. Is it really imperative for the audience that the Rainmaker dies? Like, should we actually, or that he is saved? Like, so we find out the kid is the Rainmaker, is going to be the Rainmaker. You know, well, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe he should die, right? But then, of course, we wouldn't get the payoff of the finale.
Yeah, it's clever writing to keep it a little bit nebulous, right? It's very clever to have you guessing which one is it, and is Joe good, Joe bad, is the kid good, is the kid bad, or, you know, who are you rooting for, right?
Well, yeah, and in this case where you have a paradox, that's helpful, because if you didn't sort of think that, then you wouldn't have a good payoff at the end where, spoiler alert, they do change the future and maybe he won't grow up to be the Rainmaker. So, yeah, it's all very, without dying, you know. So, pretty interesting.
Yeah, the problem that I have, or I guess the interesting thing is the logic in the film in terms of the time travel mythology, because the best example of that is when they're cutting apart Seth's older version. You know, yeah. And all of a sudden, so they have him on a hospital bed, and all of a sudden you see that, you know, his nose comes off. He starts losing limbs because what they're doing is they're doing so that cool. In the future. However, I mean, you don't assume that they're going to keep that guy alive after they're doing this surgery on him, right? So if they're eventually going to kill him, doesn't he have to vanish in his current state? Like, he doesn't get all the way to being 30 years from the future?
Yeah.
So that's an example where kind of like, it's about halfway there in terms of actually being, I guess, reasonable within the mythology that they establish, but it ultimately doesn't make a ton of sense, because for that to happen, for it to happen the way that they wanted it to, they would have had to have kept his body alive for 30 years, because otherwise it doesn't work, right?
Yeah, and this is, again, why you just can't, you can't sit there and try to take a close look at this. Why not just kill him? And then he would have just like disappeared. Well, that's not very cool to watch, but it is cool to see him like losing, you know, body parts.
Yeah.
Like,
he started climbing the fence also. And like, he sees an arrow and he's kind of like, wait, how is he getting carved? Like, like, it was really cool.
I mean, it's cool. It's totally cool.
I mean, it's an awesome concept. Don't get me wrong. It's just that the logic, I think, is a little bit strained.
That stuff, but.
Oh yeah, no. It's a very enjoyable movie for sure. Even with you got to just suspend disbelief a little bit on some of the logic associated with time travel.
I think that's the thing with time travel. Like, that's the fun part about it, is thinking about all these cases, and like, it never can work because it's impossible. So it's just one of those things to bounce around. Like, oh, but what if, or, you know, like, and I think that the carving, the tattoo or the scars. I thought that was a unique thing that
it's a great mechanic in the movie for sure. Definitely. I mean, I think it works great.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a question for you guys, which is, what would happen if suddenly you encountered yourself from 30 years in the future? And let's rewind the clock from now. So we're all 21, and our Marcus isn't quite 21 yet, but he's 20. And all of a sudden your 51-year-old self walks in and sits down across from you. What is your 21-year-old self thinking?
God, you're old.
What happened?
Hey, what happened?
I'll tell you what my 21-year-old...
What happened?
My 21-year-old self is thinking, holy fuck, dude, what disease do you have? Like, that's like, you know, it's like, When did you turn into the Crypt Keeper? Is there anything I can do to prevent this? Those are the thoughts that are jumping through my 21-year-old head, I think, at that point.
Yeah, pretty much. Dude, start going to the gym.
And then I had just one other question, which is, so what genre do you think this film is? I mean, it's obviously a sci-fi film, but where do you think the real inspiration comes from?
It does feel like a noir to some degree. I think
it's a little bit noir. I think there's a lot of Western in this movie.
I see the Western. Yeah.
I think there's a, I mean, particularly in terms of the, you know, in fact, Kid Blue has like a big holster that's hanging in front of him, and you have the, you know, the hover bikes, which
hunting down the people.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's like you get your posse together. I mean, there's a lot of Western influence in this movie, in my opinion.
They got their blunderbuss.
Yeah, definitely.
And then when you're out on the farm, I mean, it takes place in Kansas City. Kid Blue, I mean, come on. All the Gats, they look like the old huge
exactly
Colts,
Gat,
you know?
Kid. I mean, it's even the language is very Western.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a combination of sci-fi, noir, and Western. That's what it feels like to me. But it's very character-driven on top of all that, which is what makes it a good film, in my opinion. All right, well, we can move on to the standout moments and favorite scenes. Marcus, what do you got?
Mine, I enjoyed the Kid Blue interaction. So he brings back Joe to see Abe, and he sits him down, and Kid Blue just kind of goofy, pulls out his big old gun, and he's just like trying to twirl it around. And he like drops it a couple times as he's kind of like trying to show off, like, this is a real gun, not those whatever the shotgun things that they have. And then he just seems so goofy and funny. And then when Abe finally opens the door, like the metal door, he's like lower. The metal door smacks him in the head.
That was good.
Just a pretty funny scene. Like it's kind of good. Like just shows that he's a total sidekick and just kind of like you didn't expect the door to open and just smack him right in the head. It seemed more out of a, not a comedy, but it's almost like that too. It's just like, oh.
It's funny. So, you know, Noah Sagan practiced a lot, you know, twirling the gun.
Yeah.
He was professionally instructed, I believe, on how to twirl the gun.
Right. And so he did a take where he fucked it up.
Yeah.
And Ryan Johnson loved it. And,
that's funny. Put that in.
That's exactly, I was going to say, that's what he did. Yeah. He took the bad take.
Nice. Yeah. It works so well for his character.
Well, one of the scenes that, I mean, I think it's the kind of the, it's probably the, maybe the, in some respects, the showcase of the film. I think it's the diner sequence where old Joe comes and sits down and meets with young Joe for the first time. And I think that's a really great scene. And there's a lot to it. There's a lot that's happening. And one of the things I really appreciate is that when Bruce Willis comes in as old Joe and sits down, there's a moment where it's, you know, 3 to 4 seconds of effectively silence when they're just kind of looking at each other and sizing each other up. And I just think that that's allowing that space and having that beat there, I think, is really, really effective. And then I do love the interaction, just the overall interaction between the two of them, because you have young Joe who is kind of cocky and saying, you know, you're breaking the deal. It's, you know, you just need to go away and die. And then you have old Joe who is looking at his younger self with a lot of contempt and also just, you know, and kind of just taking him down left and right, honestly. I mean, it gets to the point, obviously, where it accelerates all the way to him, you know, assaulting him and hitting him with a great punch, by the way. The punch that's in the diner is really effective. But I just love the interaction between the two of them. And by the way, I really do think that this is an example where you can look at Bruce Willis and say, wow, yeah, the dude was acting. I mean, this was really good because, you know, there's a little bit of a twinkle in his eye. He's contemptuous. He's dismissive when he talks about the carving on his arm, about the fact that, hey, dumb shit, you could have put Jen on your arm instead of Beatrix, right? it's one of those things that's it's an example of him sizing up his younger self, understanding that his younger self was a dipshit and not wanting to, you know, continue down that path. And so I think that Joseph Gordon-Levitt working with Bruce Willis in this, I think it's really effective. I think they're playing off each other great. And I just think it's a fantastic scene, honestly.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it totally is. It's one of the standout scenes, if not the standout scene in the movie. just so fun to see two versions of the same person separated by 30 years sitting apart. And you're right, the disdain that he looks at young Joe. And you wonder, like, this is the other side of the question that you just asked earlier. You know, what would you say you're 30 years in the future? You're 51 or something. What would you say to your, what would you say to your 21 year old?
Apple stock.
Aside from that,
buy Microsoft first, then move on to Apple.
Yeah. Hold it for a long time.
Eventually buy some Tesla.
But I think that you might have some disdain and be like, you think you know everything. Let me tell you, you don't. And let me give you some wise advice. You know, I think there's definitely going to be a lot of that.
Well, and it's interesting too, because he has the moment where, you know, he says something and then young Joe comes back at him. And then old Joe says, shut your fucking mouth. And then he glares at him. And young Joe, it actually shuts down young Joe. So I guess the question I have is, between the two of them sitting there, I mean, old Joe obviously thinks that he's in command of the situation. Like, you know, how do you think the power is working between the two of them in that sequence?
Oh, totally.
You defer to your old self, I would think.
Well, you probably would, but you're also supposed to be killing your old self. So that's the confusion young Joe's part there.
Good point.
Well, yeah, no. Yeah, the power dynamic is very interesting. And yeah, old Joe is definitely like asserting and taking control there. He also knows like how young Joe thinks, whereas, you know, young Joe does not have that same ability.
Right.
Because he's too young. He just doesn't know. Like, he could probably tell him exactly what young Joe is thinking, you know.
I don't know what I was thinking 30 years ago.
I know that's what I was going to say. That's what's interesting to me is if you.
I have like, some tattoos that prove that I don't know what I was thinking.
Well, yeah, 21 year old self didn't know what you were thinking, but 51 year old self does know what you were thinking back then.
Do I?
Marcus, would you go back in time and stop yourself from getting those tattoos?
Maybe.
So, one other question here is, what if Willis kills the Rainmaker? So what if old Joe kills the Rainmaker in this scenario? Like, I mean, just in terms of his logic, what he's laying out in the diner sequence, right? So yes, there's a guy in the future. He's a bad guy. I want to kill him, but mainly I want to kill him because it's going to save my wife's life. But at that point, 30 or was it 55 or 56 year old Joe is stuck in the past and he's just going to wait for his younger self to potentially hook up with his wife and not be killed by the Rainmaker in the future. I mean, that's just... What is old Joe going to do after he kills the Rainmaker, I guess is my question.
He's going to take a bullet from young Joe.
I mean, honestly, yeah, nothing's going to happen to old Joe other than he'll serve out the rest of his life without his wife. But young Joe had the opportunity to experience the same life, except that it wouldn't have been the same because there still wouldn't have been... maybe he met his wife before the Rainmaker came on the scene. So there's a strong chance that he would have met his wife and she would never have died. But old Joe never would have experienced that. And the fact that young Joe is now very much caught up in, you know, Sid's life, there's just no way that that's going to happen at that point.
Right.
At the point of the finale... There's no way. The future for young Joe had changed way too much. He was never going to end up in the same position. So it was fruitless. The only thing he could do would be to save the world from having to experience the Rainmaker.
Vengeance.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Young Joe, you know, decided he was going to do it the right way.
And so, yeah.
And I think old Joe also.
Not so that the Rainmaker would never even be created, or at least put it out there so that it wouldn't happen.
I think also just vengeance to a certain degree too. He wants to extract his revenge. It's on a 6-year-old kid who hasn't done anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think about it. You get sent back in time and you're able to escape being killed and you have this key piece of information. I think I might be doing the same thing. I mean, like, well, maybe I'll just go stop the Rainmaker from ever coming into being.
See, all this depends heavily on understanding what the Rainmaker actually does in the future, right? Yeah. And that's a piece of information exposition that is not supplied in this movie.
Well, I think you can extrapolate. I think, you know, he's just like a super powerful telekinetic. It's like he's Dr. Xavier
no,
or Charles Xavier, but on crack.
I get that.
And a villain.
Xavier's not technically a telekinetic, by the way. He's a telepath. What is
it? TP. He's TP, not TK.
Okay, whatever.
Which is funny. I just read
one
the whole
of those
book.
X-Men. I Give just me read an X-Man the... who can do telekinesis.
Jean Grey. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Jean Grey on crack.
No, I get that in terms of what his abilities are. The question is, if he's going to set himself up as the Uber crime lord, for example, right, where he's going to run criminal syndicates but not necessarily expand beyond the footprint of what those syndicates were, he's just going to take it over, that's one thing. If he's marching across the world as a genocidal maniac and simply vaporizing everybody, that's a slightly different scenario, right? Yeah. So that's what's interesting about the possibilities of what is happening in the future.
Yeah. So I think this is probably kind of like obvious, but the Rainmaker is closing loops. He's closing all the loops because he's essentially searching for, he's trying to kill the Looper who killed his mother. That was my interpretation. Do you agree with that? Is that right?
I was trying to figure out what his motivation for closing the loops. I actually had that as a question in terms of, you know, why is it so important? I'd assume that it was basically just a protective move in general, right? To stop I think what he would do effectively is shut down time travel because maybe he would view it as a threat to his future
powers
state.
Yeah.
That was
because he was a new guy coming up too. So yeah.
Yeah. Because he as himself, I mean, what he would remember is he would remember his mom getting shot and himself getting shot in the jaw, right? That's what he would remember basically as a kid.
So
right?
That's probably, he's extracting revenge himself.
So he's trying to kill one of the Loopers, but then potentially also just shutting down the whole possibility that perhaps somebody would do something in the past that would actually affect his future, I guess.
Yeah. No, I like the idea that he's killing Loopers because they are what killed his mom.
I
think that makes them more sense because it's personal.
Right.
Yeah. It's like personal to him. And then why also just they set up this whole Looper program. It seemed to be working out pretty well. Why suddenly start shutting it down? Because they say after they sort of set up the world building that Seth says it, that there's this, you know, this Rainmaker in the future.
Yeah. This new guy is coming up.
And he's closing all the loops. And so everyone's contract is coming up.
Right.
And so, well, why? Why all of a sudden? And I think it's that because he's trying to, he doesn't know which Looper did it. He just remembers as a child that a Looper killed his mother.
Right.
And he saw it and he witnessed it. And so he's just saying, well, fine, I'm just going to kill all the loops.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I think that it's more, so it's personal. I guess the question I have is it's a difference between using your telekinetic power in the future to find those Loopers or find the person that killed your mom and take revenge versus, you know, and or setting up and taking over a criminal syndicate or being some sort of malevolent force that's affecting the world, right? It's not really clear as to what the Rainmaker actually is. And I think that's what causes also it makes it...
All of the above?
Yeah, well, it makes it ambiguous too as to whether or not you want this kid to die, I guess. Yeah.
Right.
You know?
I think it's done on purpose.
Yeah, no, I think it's smart screenplay in that regard.
Yeah. And in fact, and that's why I really like the finale, because Joe essentially takes all those steps. You know, like when old Joe is about to shoot, he's already shot at Sid in the field, and he's hit the mother. Or like, actually, I don't think he hit Sarah. I think she just tripped.
Mm-hmm.
But then he actually did.
He hit Sid.
He hit Sid in the jaw.
Right.
Or at least grazed him in the jaw, right? But he's not dead yet. But now this is a point where I think Sid thinks he saw his mother shot and she's now dead on the ground, right? He himself was shot and he gets very angry. And then young Joe sort of like sees the path into the future of Sid becoming the Rainmaker. Like it's just, it all starts, it falls into place, right? Yep. And he goes,
then I saw it. I saw a mom who would die for her son. A man who would kill for his wife. A boy, angry and alone, laid out in front of him the bad path. I saw it. And the path was a circle. Round and round. I changed it.
And I love that because, and then he takes the gun and kills himself and stops what he thinks could change that from all happening, which I think is a great, it's just a great ending.
It's Can a he great just ending. Shut off his hand? Like,
don't think too much into this.
No, I thought it was really good. I really liked the ending too.
The gun just drops to the ground.
He just starts to kill himself.
It turns into like Monty Python. He just starts lopping off his
I'm
own.
I'm not dead yet.
Just a flesh wound.
Nah, that was a great ending.
All right, Colin, your scene, I believe.
I think that was it.
Oh yes.
Oh, that wasn't it?
It wasn't it. No, it wasn't. You would think it was, right? No, the scene I just wanted to talk about was, which I really like, is the two scenes with Jesse when he comes calling and then when he comes back. Because I really like Garrett Dillahunt in there. He's like polite and insistent, but also threatening at the same time. I mean, anytime you're a woman alone, you know, out in the boonies, and this guy wearing all black and clearly has a weapon on him comes to your door and says, "Are you alone here, ma'am?" I mean, your heart drops a little bit. And she knows why he's there. And then you got Joe, who's hiding, and he's like sort of like moving between the rooms as they walk throughout the house to elude them. He's hiding behind the sofa with his with his gun there. And I just really like they're having this conversation. And you're sort of walking on eggshells. He's asking her all these questions about, has she seen this guy? Does she have a kid? He's obviously very suspicious. Seems like he's believing her. And then here comes Sid walking down the stairs. And it's like, oh, shit. Like, but he like just sort of like calmly walks down quietly and walks right behind Jesse as he's talking. And then, boom, there's a sound in the kitchen. And that opens up a window for Joe to get out under the stairs. Just, I really like that scene. And then it's followed up shortly thereafter with Joe coming downstairs and boom, Jesse's back and he's got a shotgun or he's got a gun on Sarah. He's holding her. And that whole scene is really good. It's also like, it's tense. And you can see, you know, Joe even says that he liked Jesse. He calls him like a good guy. So you almost have a little bit of empathy for old Jesse, but
then he gets blowed up.
Yeah. But then he's like, you know, very calmly, Sarah, Jesse's like a great shot. You know, like he's going to let you go. Just go immediately, sit down on the sofa. Like, let's not get this situation out of control. And then Sid starts walking down the stairs and he creaks on the step. And immediately Jesse wheels around and points his gun and Sid slips and he falls. And this is such a great scene. It's like really a lot of tension and there's like slow motion. And, you know, Sarah's like lunging for Sid to grab him because he's like falling down the stairs.
And no, like, she goes the other way.
Well, no. You're like, is she going to catch him? And no, she's not going for Sid. She's basically tackling Joe.
Yeah.
So she can like pull him out of the house because she knows what's going to happen. And you see Sid just like slow-mo, that look on his face. He's just like angry.
Yeah, that's actually like, an example of the good child acting here. He's definitely crushing it.
Yeah, and he's just like so angry. And all of a sudden you see all this furniture comes like rising up, including Jesse. And the look on Jesse's face is like, what the fuck is going? You just, I don't know. What would you call what happened to Jesse? He was like...
Explodes.
He explodes?
Yeah.
He explodes.
He just blows him up.
Yeah. I mean, that scene is just amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
Smart filmmaking too, in terms of actually having them run outside and then all you have to do is show the explosion versus showed what happened to Jesse in detail. Because really they just have him hanging there and you have the, you know, some of the digital blood work probably is what they're doing there, I would imagine.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then of course, like just after that, you know, Joe immediately puts it all together. Like, oh, Sid's the Rainmaker, some super powerful telekinetic. just good stuff. So yeah, that particular scene really just stands out for me.
That's a good one.
I have a couple of just last minute questions. So how much money do you think a looper makes during their career in terms of what do they take into retirement? By the way, there is a very detailed Reddit thread on this topic that I found that goes through in terms of the approximate weight of each of those bars and what that translates to. And what they ended up saying is that a looper's career could net to like $1.2 million, which doesn't sound like enough money for me to live on 30 years of your life, right? Because I assume that the contract that they're pitching to the loopers is, hey, if you do this for a while, it might be a little unpleasant, but you'll have 30 years of bliss and then you die, which ultimately probably doesn't sound like a horrible thing.
Let's talk real world.
Okay.
You're about 25 years old and now you got $1.2 million. Have you heard of a 401k plan?
Well,
so if you're in Kansas City in a dystopian world too, like it's very hard to judge what the cost of living is there.
I think it's a pretty good send off is you've made like $1.2 million. Now you can put that into some stocks and bonds and you can start really having your money work for you and you'll be pretty good. Cause I know I didn't have $1.2 million when I was 25 years old.
Yeah, but they're going to blow it all on eye drop drugs.
Right, as I say, you gotta break the eye drop habit.
That is true.
Yeah. And then one other just random note. So the diner that they had in the film, which I thought was actually pretty, you know, cool looking as what I'm sure would be a slightly anachronistic building at that point in time. But the diner that they built it specifically for this movie. And I just think it's funny that local townspeople were coming by and were asking when it was going to open so they could get some breakfast.
I don't think they're doing a lot of shooting a lot of movies there in that part of Louisiana.
Yeah.
Funny.
One of the other things that sticks out in my mind about this movie is the term blunderbuss. So that's the gun that the loopers use because it like doesn't work for shit, you know, outside of like 15 yards, but you can't miss inside 15 yards or maybe it's 15 feet, I think it was. So I looked up the term blunderbuss and it's of Dutch origin from the Dutch word donderbus, which is a combination of donder, meaning thunder, and bus, meaning pipe. So it's literally my thunder pipe. This is my thunder pipe.
This is my boomstick.
By the way, the funny thing there is blunderbuss is a term I always associated it with the weapons that pirates used. Like that's my association with blunderbuss. Like I would think it's a it's a carbine.
It's like a shortened shotgun. It's a precursor to the shotgun. Yeah. It's a shortened version of it. And yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yep. All right. Well, anything else you guys would like to mention in regards to Looper or most likely something besides Looper based on this conversation?
Any other Dutch words you want to?
you know how like Joe is, he's learning French.
Yeah.
Rian Johnson wanted him to end up, you know, like retiring to France, right? He doesn't do that. He goes to China. And Rian Johnson, he was going to shoot it in New Orleans as a stand-in for Paris, but he rejected the idea. But the Chinese distributor of the film offered to pay for the crew, like pay for the whole thing for the crew to go to Shanghai and film. And so they accepted it. And so he rewrote the script so that he actually goes to Shanghai. And that's the montage for that you see, which is a really great montage, by the way. I really love that. Seeing Joe from year one to like year 30. All in Shanghai. So that's the reason for that. But I do love Abe when, what does Abe say to young Joe?
Why the fuck French?
I'm going to France.
You should go to China.
I'm going to France.
I'm from the future. You should go to China.
That's just a great thing. Because he said, again, he says, he's like so weary. He's like, oh, trust me, I'm from the future.
Yeah. That's good.
That's good stuff. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, guys. What did you learn from this movie? Marcus?
I learned once again, being an assassin is not a great profession and karma will eventually catch up with you.
Colin?
I learned that 8 times 3 is 32. And that telekinesis is not as exciting as we thought it would be.
I learned basically by seeing Bruce Willis's appearance as he came back through the door of the diner that, like, yep, I'm right on the right track for what I would look like in the future. So I'm apparently old Joe right now. That's who I am. I'm old Joe.
Closing thoughts.
Marcus, what do you got?
I really enjoyed it. I thought Looper is a smart movie. I thought the writing was really good. It's a fun look at sci-fi and time travel. And I thought a good character study, good acting by all the leads. And I thought it was really good. I think it's an enjoyable sci-fi movie. Worth watching for sure. My letter grade would probably be B+.
Colin.
I just think this is a great film by Rian Johnson with some really good performances by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Emily Blunt, and Bruce Willis. Just a really, really interesting take on the time travel concept and then inserting that into a really good story set in a somewhat near future, dystopian future. Just an overall well-done movie. And I'm going to give it an A-.
Yeah, so I think we're all relatively close. I do think that the world building and the, you know, sort of, I guess, the mechanics that they use for time travel and the whole idea that you build a movie that involves time travel or you create a movie that has time travel, but time travel is not the focus, I think is really interesting. It just makes for a very interesting movie, right? Because it's funny because there's this awesome invention of time travel, and what are they really using it for? Like a garbage chute. I mean, that's what they're actually using it for. So it's just kind of a crazy, yeah. It's a crazy representation of what you possibly could do with time travel. By the way, if time travel was a really thing, the idea that national governments wouldn't be on top of that and be competing against each other to go back and change the past or whatever, I mean, come on. But anyways, I do think that the three leads, so I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt is great in this movie. I think Bruce Willis is really good. And I think Emily Blunt's really good too. So I think that the three of them are, you know, are all really strong performances. And the kid, Sid, I think it actually for a child actor does a really good job. And I think the story is very, I think this is a very tight movie. I think it works really well. I mean, it establishes the rules a little bit, asks you not to push on them too hard in terms of thinking it through when it comes to the paradoxes and all that kind of stuff. But I do think that just the, you know, there's maybe one scene and everything else feels really tight. And to me, that's sort of emblematic of Rian Johnson as a director, as a writer-director. I think his stories and his direction just work really well together. So I enjoy his films and look forward to whatever he does next. And the letter grade for me would be an A-. All right, well, moving on. So this is my pick. So, and again, I'm going to use a very sophisticated process for making this pick, which is I was watching the Warriors game. They ended, or the game was over. So then I flipped over to the next channel, landed on a movie. I was looking at him like, well, I know this movie. I'm like, that's Jake Gyllenhaal. And I'm like, wait a minute. Is that Maggie Gyllenhaal? And then 2 seconds later, I'm like, there's a Patrick Swayze cameo in this movie? And I had no idea. So I would like to go back and take a look at it. So the movie we are going to watch is Donnie Darko.
Oh, cool.
Interesting. Okay.
Because I'm actually super curious about this. Because
This movie's been done to death.
What do you mean?
Oh, I just...
Colin's against
so,
it.
So, this movie... No, it's just been so written about. Yeah, people fascinated with this movie.
No, that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in doing this, because there is a huge following for this movie. It's, you know, renowned as a cult film, and at the time when I saw it, there was a lot of buildup to it, and I personally recall watching it and being very underwhelmed, and so I don't know if I just saw it on a bad day, or it didn't hook me, or whatever, but clearly, I don't remember the movie at all, because... I had no idea that, for example, that Maggie Gyllenhaal was in it. So I'm curious to go back and watch it. And the fact that it's a cult film and it's really highly regarded, I think is very interesting. Is it going to hold up? I have no idea. So I just know that my perception at the time when I first saw it was I didn't quite get the hype. So I'm super curious to go back and watch it again. So it'll be a little bit like, it'll be a very fresh watch for me. Because as far as I know, I've only seen the movie once and that was, you know, 20 years ago, whenever it came out.
Yeah, it's the same for me. I've only seen it once. Is it about time travel too?
What I was going to say. Yeah,
there's some sort of a time travel element. So that was the other thing that probably popped into my head in terms of, oh yeah, Looper. Let's just get on the time travel jag for a while. I guess.
No, it's funny because I didn't remember that at all. And then I was looking up at any of the questions that come up, favorite time travel movies. So I was looking up. I'm like, oh my god, what are some Like Donnie Darko, that was time travel? I don't remember.
Yeah, I think I remember next to nothing about that movie, so I'm super curious about it.
I thought it was a demented Easter movie.
I thought it was like a horror movie, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was a horror movie. But I still think it is, so I don't know what I'm in for.
Great. So yeah, we'll just all go into it with relatively fresh eyes, and we'll be taking a look at Donnie Darko. So that'll be our next movie.
Fun. Yeah, it was on my list also as one to pick because I have not. It's the same reasons too. Like I haven't seen it in a long time. And
yeah, I'm honestly super curious and interested. So that'll be our next one.
Fun. Good one.
Well, I still think you need to maybe redo your strategy, but I think you lucked out this time because I think that is a pretty interesting pick.
I'm not sure that my strategy is any worse than your strategy. So. By the way, strategy in all cases, using air quotes there. So.
Quote unquote strategy. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, we can wrap this up. So hope you enjoyed our definitely rambling conversation about Looper. I think we've all learned a valuable lesson here, Looper? Which is we should probably pod a little bit closer to when we actually watch the movie.
It was like 80% Looper.
Yeah, it's mostly 70. Looper. Yeah. But I guess we'll just say this is the Real DMC Podcast, signing off. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. So we've done a couple films before, and then... Like I had not seen them because I had not heard of this guy. Oh boy.
Hello? Hey, what's up? Okay.
Dude, I'm trying to do a podcast here.
No, we're covered here. Yeah. Okay.
No, all man, right, I don't want any of your insurance.
I'm podcasting right now, so we'll see you next month, but we'll see if you need help. Hey, Jess? She's back in town.
Mia's picking up some Chipotle. Dad, do you want any Chipotle? No, I don't. I'm doing a podcast.
No Chipotle?
Sorry about that.
Hey, man, can you call Mia back and tell her to pick me up a burrito?
Can you guys get your orders in and I'll fucking relay them to her and then you can drive up here and grab them? Yes. Good times in the Harris household. COVID and Chipotle. That's what we got going right now.